Sairam and welcome dear listeners to this week's afternoon satsang. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai with Arvind, and we are here to continue the story of the Srimad Bhagavatam as penned by Swami in his Bhagavata Vahini. Before this, we had gone through the Ramakatha Rasvahini, and many times when we go through that, we would see that Swami's emphasis on various parts of the story would depend on what we really need to absorb from that story, and that is what actually makes the reading of these books very, very important. And we are going through that one particular chapter in the Bhagavat Vahini, of course, in the sequence as we've been going through, where Swami speaks of an episode which we've heard many times, which we've seen dramatized many times, but probably the things which we would have missed because of our superficial way of looking at these episodes and reading them. So we're going to go through that episode from Swami's point of view, where Swami gives us inputs of what we really need to grasp from these episodes. But before going into what that episode is and before narrating the stories that follow, I invite Brother Arvind to join all of us, and together, on behalf of all of you, we offer our humble pranams at Swami's lotus feet. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Preman, as you rightly said, it becomes a very enlightening and wonderful thing to read Bhagwan's Bhagavata Vahini. Bhagavata Vahini compared to the Bhagavatam, because the Bhagavatam is possibly different people's opinion and view about the stories, mortal view, right. But this is the immortal view, if I can say it so, because as you rightly said, the way Bhagwan has placed emphasis on different parts and different aspects, it's totally different. It allows us to see it in a different light. For example, in the Ramayana, when we read the traditional Ramayana, even when we see the way it is divided, at around the 25% mark, we see Sita getting kidnapped, you know, by Ravana. So that is how the traditional Ramayanas go. But when we look at Bhagwan's Ramakatha Rasavahini, it's there as two parts, part one and part two. And even at the end of part one, Sita is not yet kidnapped. If I remember right, at the end of part one, it is Bharata going to the forest and requesting Rama to return back. So you'll wonder, what is this? I mean, it looks so skewed, but the reality is the other Ramayanas are possibly skewed. And the way Swami has presented the Ramayana is in the manner in which we need maximum inputs, where we need maximum emphasis. So the same holds good for Bhagavata Vahini also. And last week we were discussing about the episode of Khandava forest being burnt, and how Krishna goes around to ensure that none of the animals and birds in the forest are able to escape while the forest is burning. And on the face of it looks like he's such a cruel god.
Right.
It's okay that destiny has it or fate has it that this forest has to burn. But in case there are some beings that are managing to escape, why not allow them to escape? But I think we covered that in great detail last week, where we also saw the modern day phenomenon of something called a fire debt, where modern science has realized, especially in the state of California in America, that you can't just keep fighting all these forest fires and putting them off, because forest fires too have their role to play and they need to burn on. Otherwise, it builds up this fire debt to such a large extent that when finally a fire breaks out, say 10 years down the line, 20 years down the line, it becomes devastatingly terrible and it causes damage which is 100 times, 1000 times more than the 10 forest fires that you have put out so far. So what we realized last week was everything that the Lord does on the spur of the moment, when we are not looking into the past or into the future, things look like God is attached or God is cruel, God is unkind, God is insensitive, God is oversensitive. But for all these situations, all we need to do is take a broader perspective, open up our hearts, enlarge our minds. And when we look at it in this perspective, we realize that everything is in perfect harmony. And this realization will hit us with greater force today as we discuss an episode that is possibly been touted as the cause for the entire Mahabharata war, the seed which resulted in the Kurukshetra war, that is the humiliation and disrobing of Draupadi in the open court. And as we discuss this episode this week, as I said, we will realize the importance of perspective.
The one thing is, of course, Swami's narration of that incident itself is a little different, because we don't picturize it as Swami has narrated it. There's some details which are different. But you know, one thing which I think we've mentioned many times, even during the Ramayana Satsang, one of the problems for us is we know these stories like the back of our hand. So we listen to it with a little bit of, you know, abandon. We don't really look into the details. But, you know, when you suddenly step back and say that, let's say that I don't know the story and I'm listening to it, you find that so many wonders in it and so many parallels you will find, you know, when you go through difficult times in your life, how you can find grace in the period that you're suffering. Some of the things which Swami highlights, and you know, he literally pulls your attention to it and says, this is what it is. You know, they did not suffer, they did not lose. And you know, when you look at it that way, look at the story like a person who has not heard the story, and you say, oh, Krishna did this, Krishna did that. And the other thing is, of course, one thing which comes out from that dialogue between Arjuna and Yudhishthira, which we spoke of a few months ago, when Swami speaks of, you know, when Dharmaraj is trying to reason out why all the sequence of events happened after the death of Krishna. And Arjuna says that, you know, you can never understand the ways of the Lord. You could be the closest devotee, you could be the greatest scholar, but you cannot understand the ways of the Lord. And that is the same thing with every epic. In fact, when we speak of the Ramayana, some of the episodes of Rama sending away Sita and all that, of course, we give our understanding, which is after a lot of churning. But if you look at it, it's so difficult to come to terms with. And, you know, many times when scholars speak of it, they say, this is God, he's come in a human form, and these are the things he did, and you're not able to come to terms with it. How will you be able to accept what God does in your life? The unseen hand of God doing things in your life, where will you find the surrender to accept it? And you know, that is why it becomes very important to look at these stories and look at it sometimes from God's point of view and not from the devotee's point of view. And that is when you will realize the love with which, even when God permits something really atrocious to happen to you, with what love he permits that to happen.
You know, again and again it reminds me of a mother or a father taking their baby out for a vaccination shot. You know, it is something that is painful and terrible. As far as the baby is concerned, it's like the end of the earth, that shot that it's going to get poked with. But the mother and father seem to be allowing it. In fact, after that, as the baby grows, you know, when the baby is very small, it's okay, the pain comes and the baby forgets. But once the child grows a little bit, along with the physical pain comes this pain of being ditched by its own parents, you know. I trusted you, mom. I trusted you, dad. I held on to you for protection and you went and submitted me to the doctor and that guy poked me and I'm in such pain. So the physical pain is one thing, but how could you do this to me? That pain comes and I feel that is how it is. We are all looking up to God and saying, Swami, how could you do this to me? How could you allow this to me? I have been a good child. I have been this. And that's all it is. Just like the parent can tell the child that, you know, child, you grow up. Once you grow up, you'll understand. Once you become an adult, you'll understand. I feel Swami is also telling us the same thing. You have to evolve and grow up. Once you grow up, you'll understand that everything is for your good. In that scenario, we are really lucky to have a perspective which is God's perspective. It's not that we have to make effort to find out his perspective, because he has himself penned it down. And we will be going into that episode. We already saw last week how the Pandavas have been invited by the Kauravas for the game of dice. We also gave reasons and possible justifications as to why Yudhishthira had to accept this so-called gambling game. And in that they lose everything that they have, they lose themselves, and they even lose Draupadi. And that is when Duryodhana commands his brother Dushasana to go into the inner chambers and drag out the servant maid Draupadi, because that's how he addresses her, because of his own idea that she insulted him when he had visited Indraprastha.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened. Dushasana goes, and when Draupadi refuses to come out, he just goes, catches her by her tresses, her hair opens up, and he drags her, holding her by the hair. And in the open assembly, she is dragged on the steps and brought down and brought to the center. And even as Vyasa is narrating this, Parikshit is unable to bear this. And as we said last week, he flares up. He asks Vyasa, what happened to this assembly of so-called great men? Were they all eating grass? I mean, were they, even demons and rakshasas if anything happens to their women, they take it as a taint on their entire clan. How could this entire assembly of scholars, great people and warriors, generals, grandsires, how could they sit and not speak anything? What happened to them? Did they become dumb? Did their brain take a vacation? I mean, these are not the words Swami has written, but something to that effect. What happened? And it is with great anger and hurt that Parikshit questions, which Vyasa smiles and assuages.
The context of this whole thing happening and how atrocious it is probably necessary to see, because even as early as, you know, there is that beautiful episode from the life of Chhatrapati Shivaji, you know, where he conquers a different land. He wages a war against a Muslim king, and he has conquered the land. I think the king flees away, the fort is being captured, and he has a queen who is very young, right? And what the other generals and ministers, they do, they go capture the queen and they bring her to Shivaji. And Shivaji is like, that's probably, I think, one of the first few battles that he wins. Mm-hmm. And he looks at them and says, what are you doing? You know, why have you brought the queen to me? They said, you know, when you win over a kingdom, they say that in this land, all the king's possessions, the Badshah's possessions become yours, and this is the queen of the Badshah. And he says, no, at the end of the day, she is a woman. And he goes and seeks apology from that queen for what his men have done. And he requests that you go and stay with my mother till we find suitable arrangements for you. You decide, do you want to go back to your father or do you want to wait till your husband comes back to claim you? And if you want to wait till he comes back, you can stay with my mother as her daughter. You know, that is the amount of respect you're supposed to give to a woman, even if you are having an upper hand, right? And this is not in the days of the Yod, this is probably less than 200 years ago. You know, that is the history of this country. And in this land, in the court of Kauravas, which are supposed to be like, you know, literally one of the most powerful kingdoms in the land, and also one of the, you know, people who are upholding the culture of this land, there in the court, in the presence of somebody like Bhishma and Dronacharya and the Pandavas themselves, for such a thing to be inflicted upon a queen, forget a queen, even a woman, a normal woman, was absolutely unacceptable. And, you know, that is why probably Swami writes it in such a way that Parikshit is beginning to flare up even before the sequence of events are narrated. Of course, he knows the story, he must have heard it many times, but the mere mention of the episode actually makes him lose his cool, and he starts flaring up against all of those elders who, you know, literally witnessed this thing happen without raising a voice.
Vyasa immediately smiles, he understands the pain in Parikshit's heart, and he tries to calm the child down. He says, my child, you calm down. It's not as if people were witnessing the scene with joy or with indifference. Vyasa then speaks of the tremendous pain that each and every elder seated in the court underwent, be it Bhishma, be it Vidura, even Dhritarashtra. A father who has become legendary for his blind attachment to the son. You know, his blindness is not just physical, but it's also symbolic. That's how Bhagwan has also stated it in many of his discourses. He had blind attachment towards Duryodhana, and in his opinion, whatever Duryodhana does can never be wrong. That is the kind of blind attachment that Dhritarashtra has. Even such a blind Dhritarashtra feels that what is happening is not right. I think we mentioned this last week, that whatever the Kauravas did, though they were all terrible and immoral, almost everything they did were within the confines of legality. And we see such things happening in the world today also, where people do things that are legal, but they're immoral. They hurt. You know that it is not right. At the same time, you know that you can't charge the person in a court of law because he's done nothing illegal. And it is at those times we begin to wonder about the divine justice. We say, you know what, this guy is a crook. He's smart. He knows how to manipulate the system, and he gets away. And others who are not so smart are suffering. So smartness is the most important aspect that is required. That is the kind of feeling that we get in the world today. You know, if you're smart, you'll survive. If you're not smart, you're gone. But I think when we read in detail this episode, this is one thing that Swami makes it very clear, that good is good. Satyameva jayate. Truth alone will triumph. Satyameva. They didn't say satyam jayate. That's amazing, right? They said satyameva jayate. Truth alone will triumph. It's not like truth will triumph, don't worry. Others may be triumphing, but truth also will triumph. No. others will not triumph. It may look like it has an upper hand, but ultimately only truth triumphs. So, that becomes very clear. You know, because many times when we see in the short span, we feel that something that is going wrong, they're triumphing smartness. But if we hold on to goodness, satya and dharma, we will come out victorious. And that becomes very, very clear in this episode. And Vyasa calms Parikshit by saying, all of them are being tormented. Even Dhritarashtra is feeling like that. So, though what Duryodhana and others seem to be doing seems legal, and that is how the blind king has been supporting them always, saying, but what wrong did my son do? What wrong did my son do? This is allowed, this is allowed, this is allowed. Even such a person finally comes and says, no, no, I think this is wrong, this should not be done. And this is possibly the flashpoint. You know, till now they were building up the fuel that's going to burn down the entire clan, and this was that flashpoint that is necessary to set it aflame so that the entire thing burns down. Because here was an act that was illegal, that was immoral, that was in every way wrong. And Swami famously would say in his discourses, Vinashakale Viparita Buddhi. When the time of destruction is ready, your mind, your discrimination goes haywire. This is possibly that act of indiscrimination where all the Kaurava discrimination went haywire and they committed this atrocity.
The other aspect of this entire scene which Vyasa corrects, not only for Parikshit, for all of us, is, you know, it is not a scene of a helpless woman who is being dragged into a court of apathetic onlookers. Because he says that Draupadi was not a powerless one. The way she was, you know, the virtue that she had collected was so powerful that Vyasa says sparks of fire were coming out of her eyes. And had she even looked at anybody in that court, they would have been turned to ashes. She did not even look at Dushasana, who was doing this to her. Not at either of these Kauravas who were, you know, hurling abuses at her. Not even at all these elders who were not looking at, were not stopping this act. She was constantly looking at the face of Yudhishthira. And you know, what a beautiful description of Yudhishthira that Swami gives in that paragraph where he says Yudhishthira was completely calm, completely, you know, in equanimity. There was no fear in him, there was no remorse in him, there was no anger in him. He was absolutely calm. And looking at his face, Draupadi became calm. You know, if you are undergoing some suffering and if you're looking at a person who is indifferent to you,
It'll
only make you angry. But here is Swami saying that Draupadi looked at Yudhishthira and she became calm. And that will happen only if that person is really calm because of a spiritual, maturity. You know, that's what we would see many times when Swami, you know, when we are in extreme trouble, you're going to Swami and you're telling him, Swami, these are my problems. And Swami says, Manchidi, or, you know, Kurcho. And we don't realize that it calms us down so much. Even though we are not able to get what we want from Swami, probably a vibhuti at that moment.
Or a solution
in the form of Swami's advice. But when Swami says Kurcho, you automatically sometimes feel calm. Because you know that Swami's calmness is not because of indifference, but it's about a very superior understanding of the situation. And that's what they said that could be seen on the face of Yudhishthira. Because a calm which could not be explained by what was happening around him. And seeing him, Draupadi became so calm that she kept looking at him and did not look at anybody else in the court, which actually did, in fact, save all of those people who were sitting in the court.
As Swami writes it, if she had not looked at Yudhishthira and looked at anybody else, Swami writes that the Kurukshetra war would have been superfluous. It would not have been necessary at all because the entire court would have got destroyed in that anger. In fact, Swami writes that not just Draupadi, even the other Pandava brothers, they were looking at Yudhishthira. And it was his calm that was calming them, because otherwise we know Bhima what he's capable of, we know Arjuna what he's capable of. And all of them were kept calm by just Yudhishthira's calm. As I was reading this prema, I was feeling, look at this, it highlights two important things. One, the first one is the power of anger. You know, because Swami writes that Draupadi's anger was enough to finish off the whole court. You know, the whole thing would have burned to ashes if she had not looked at Yudhishthira. So that shows the tremendous power of anger. Because though I'm not able to quote the exact discourses, I'm sure we have heard it in different contexts at different points in time in different details. But The spirit is that, Swami says, almost 1 month or 3 months worth of energy and spiritual practices that you have built up gets exhausted in a single bout of anger. So anger is definitely like something like a nuclear bomb, you know, that's exploding. It explodes, releasing tremendous energy which can go and cause destruction around. So that is one thing that we learn when we read this. The second thing that becomes clear is the power of peace, the power of calm. Because here is that nucleus and nuclear energy that's exploding. It's almost like Yudhishthira's calm is a nuclear reactor that is able to harness that energy and, you know, derive benefit, bring benefit out of that also. It's almost like that. It shows the power of anger, but it also shows the power of calm, which is more powerful than anger, more useful and more beneficial as well.
And looking at that scene, if you just imagine that, here are five of the greatest warriors, you know, at that period of time. You're talking about Bhima, you're talking about Arjuna. In fact, Nakula, Sahadeva and Yudhishthira were no less. They were equally, you know, ominous warriors. But here are five people, they're not bound by anything. I mean, there are no chains binding them. They're not in a prison. They're just bound by their own righteousness. They say that we have lost, we have willfully played and we have lost. The other person might have tricked us, but we have lost. And they're just imprisoned by their own values. I mean, can you imagine that? You know, you're in a country where even if you catch a fellow who has done something wrong and put him in a prison, you have to ensure that you have 300 policemen looking after him all the time to ensure that he doesn't escape. But here are the warriors who actually probably no wall can contain them, no chains can stop them, but they were just sitting there unmoved because they were bound by their word, by their virtue. And it appears like they probably, you know, righteousness has become a weakness for them. But, you know, that is
what the modern day context will tell you.
That is what the modern people will look at it as. But that is where Swami's explanation becomes very important. But we'll come to that in a bit. But, you know, here is Draupadi. Till now it is fine. She's been dragged to the court. She's been hurled abuses at. But now Duryodhana says, start disrobing her. This becomes a real, you know, literally the last straw of her patience at that point. And then she starts crying out everybody in the court and nobody is there to respond and, you know, save her from that.
That is the thing. She reaches her breaking point, but there is no loss of serenity on the face of Dharmaraja. And again, in the modern day context, one would call him as a weakling, as a spineless person, but we know that it is not that. We know that his power is such that he is able to, you know, keep these four atom bombs on his side silent. In fact, in one of these informal talks, I remember when Swami came out and he was speaking to the students, he was saying that today people speak of might, countries, the might of the country. And Swami said, people say America is so strong, USSR is so powerful. And indeed, that's the case. Even just yesterday evening when I was looking at the money spent on armament and the armaments at their disposal, number one in the world is America, number two is Russia, number three is China. And India is somewhere far below, number nine, number ten, something like that. And Swami on that day was saying that America is like Bhima, very powerful, very... It may have everything. It has tanks. It has weaponry. Russia is like Arjuna. But India should be like Yudhishthira. What was Yudhishthira's weapon of choice? Technically, it's a spear. You know, a spear. But nobody remembers anything about Yudhishthira. In fact, his name is Dharmaja or Dharmaraja. Because his weapon was Dharma. And that's what happened. Swami says, though he was not the strongest, though he was not the most skillful, though he was not the most smart, yet smartness, intelligence, power, everything bowed down before him because he was an epitome of dharma. And Swami said that is what India should become. That is what Bharat should be, because Bharat is the crest jewel of dharma. It is supposed to have its weapon of dharma. And that also becomes evident here, because even Draupadi now is broken down, her anger is now turned into pleas for mercy, and yet Yudhishthira sits calm, and Draupadi realizes that I am not going to get any help from Yudhishthira directly as of now, And because Yudhishthira is like that, I don't think any of the other husbands are also going to step up. Now if these five don't step up, I don't see anybody else in this court who is going to step up. Who else is there for me other than Krishna who can help me? But as Swami is going to narrate in the discourse, even when she calls out to Krishna, even Krishna doesn't seem to be stepping up. I think we'll hear this interesting narration in Bhagwan's own beautiful voice.
Right, this is from a clip which Swami, discourse that Swami delivered on 20th of May 1993 as part of the summer course.
భగవంతుడు ఎక్కడ ఉంటున్నాడంటే హృదయంలో ఉంటున్నాడు.
సో ఇఫ్ యు ఆస్క్ వేర్ ఇస్ గాడ్, హీ ఇస్ ఇన్ వన్స్ ఓన్ హార్ట్.
ఏ ద్వారకావాస,
వెన్ వి సే
ఏ బృందావన సంచారి, ఏ మధురాపుర విహారి అని అనేక రకములుగా ప్రార్థించింది ద్రౌపది.
ద్రౌపది ప్రేడ్ ఇన్ డిఫరెంట్లీ, ఓ గాడ్ హూ ఇస్ ఇన్ మధుర.
కానీ ఎన్ని ప్రార్థించినప్పటికీ వర్ణించినప్పటికీ కృష్ణుడు రాలేదు.
ఇన్ స్పైట్ ఆఫ్ ఆల్ సాల్స్ సచ్ కాల్స్ కృష్ణ హాస్ నాట్ రెస్పాండెడ్.
అలసిపోయింది.
She was tired.
స్వరం కూడాను రాలేకపోయింది.
She lost her tone.
హే హృదయవాసి అని పడిపోయింది.
She fell down saying that, oh God, dwell in the heart. Immediately Krishna manifested.
తిరిగి కొంతకాలమైన తర్వాత ఒంటరిగా చిక్కినప్పుడు కృష్ణుని ప్రశ్నిస్తూ వచ్చింది ద్రౌపది.
లెఫ్ట్ లేటర్ ఫైండింగ్ కృష్ణ ఆల్ అలోన్ ద్రౌపది క్వశ్చన్.
సోదరా, ఆనాడు నాకంత పరాభవం జరిగేటువంటి సమయం లోపల ఎన్ని పర్యాయములు నిన్ను పిలిచినప్పటికీ ఎందుకు రాలేదు?
లేటర్ సెడ్ బ్రదర్, దో ఐ కాల్ యూ రిపీటెడ్లీ వెన్ ఐ వాస్ హ్యూమిలియేటెడ్, వై డిడ్ యు నాట్ రెస్పాండ్?
అవునమ్మా, రాలేదు.
Yes, I didn't come.
కారణం చెప్పమంటావా?
Shall I tell you the reason?
ఏ ద్వారకావాసి అని పిలిచావు.
You called me saying, oh, they
నేను దగ్గర ఉండేటువంటి వాడిని కూడాను నీ మాటకు సత్యాన్ని నిలబెట్టుకునే నిమిత్తమే నేను ద్వారకు పోయి రావాలి.
Though I'm near you to say, to uphold the truth what you said, I had to go to Dwaraka and come back.
ఈ ఆ కాలం లోపల హెలికాప్టర్స్, ఎలిప్లేన్లు ఏమైనా ఉంటున్నాయా? లేవే.
Those times there's no aeroplane or any transport.
కనుక ఇన్నిన్ని రకములుగా నీవు ప్రార్థించావు.
You prayed in different ways.
బృందావన విహారి అంటే నేను బృందావనానికి పోయి రావాలి.
When you said Vrindavan Vihari,
నీ పాట నీ మాటకు సరి అనుకుంటే సత్యం ఉండదు.
I have to come from Vrindavan because there will be no truth in what you said.
సత్యం చేకూర్చే నిమిత్తమై నేను తిరిగి అక్కడికి పోయి రావటంలో ఆలస్యమైపోతుంది.
Only to demonstrate truth in what you said, I had to go, therefore the delay.
హృదయవాసి అన్నావు, నేను తక్షణమే వచ్చాను.
When you said,
ఉన్నాను అక్కడే వచ్చాను.
When you said the indweller in the heart, since I am there, I manifested.
కనుకో భక్తులకు వాక్యాన్ని పరిపాలన చేసే నిమిత్తమై భగవంతుడి కొడను అనేక రకములైనటువంటి యొక్క మార్పులు చేయవలసి వస్తుంటాయి.
To uphold what all that is said by the devotee, God has to change.
నీవు బృందావన విహారిని చెప్పినప్పుడు నేను బృందావన పోకుండా గిన వస్తే నీ మాటలో సత్యం ఉండదు.
When you call Vrindavan Vihari, if I don't go to Vrindavana, there will be no truth in what you said.
సత్యం కంఠస్య భూషణం.
The truth is the true jewel to the neck.
కంఠమునకు భూషణము సత్యము.
The truth is the proper jewel to the neck.
కనుక నిన్ను సత్య స్వరూపునిగా చేసే నిమిత్తమై నేను ఈ విధమైన అవస్థలు పడవలసి వస్తుంది.
To show the truth in what you said, I had to suffer.
కనుక భగవంతుడు అనేటువంటిది హృదయవాసి.
So God is in our heart.
ఎక్కడ ఉంటున్నాడు అన్నప్పుడు ఎక్కడ ఉంటున్నాడు?
He's everywhere.
కానీ ఇంత సమీపంలో మరొక చోటు చిక్కదు మనకు.
But there's no other place closer than one's own heart.
తల్లి కంటి మిగులు దైవం మే దగ్గర.
God is much nearer than one's own mother.
తల్లైనా కొంత దూరంగా ఉంటుండొచ్చు కొంతకాలము.
Mother may at times be away.
దైవం దూరంగా ఉండడానికి వీల్లేదు.
God will never be.
అతనికి దూరం అనేదే లేదు.
There's no distance.
అనగా తానే దైవము.
Meaning you are the divine.
ఇలాంటి సత్యాన్ని మనం చక్కగా గుర్తించుకుంటూ రావాలి.
We should recognize the truth.
So that was the episode where Swami says that when Draupadi calls out Mathura Nivasi Krishna, Krishna says that in order to uphold the truth that you have spoken, I have to travel all the way to Mathura and then come. And finally, when she is tired and she calls out to the Hridayavasi Krishna, the Krishna who is the indweller of the heart, Krishna manifests instantly and we know what happens. You know, Dushasana is trying to pull the sari and over there Krishna is generating a Guinness Book of World Records, kilometers and kilometers long sari, and how much ever Dushasana, who is a powerful bodybuilder, tries, he is unable to disrobe Draupadi. He falls down in fatigue. The whole Kaurava court seems to tremble in fear, and there is gratitude in the hearts of the Pandavas. That is what actually happens. And you know, it's so beautiful. I think only Swami can so nicely give the real meaning of the incident, you know. Till this point in time, Draupadi is having fear, she is having anger, she is having sorrow. And though she is in a court where she is supposed to be a queen, though she is in the presence of not one but five of her husbands, she is helpless and she is in a nadir of sorrow. It's not a small sadness or a little sorrow. It's the depth. You can't go further down in sorrow. That is the kind of situation she is in. And in such situation, even calling out the Lord's name is not helping her. And finally, what helps her, as Swami says, is when she realizes that Krishna is in my heart. And Swami, you know, in the discourse said, what does that mean? It means you are God. He says, the moment Draupadi realizes that, understands it, instantly things change. It's like night becomes day. In an instant she is at peace. And in fact, I think you had only pointed out the other time we were having this discussion. When we look at all the paintings of Draupadi being disrobed, you will see that she is not even trying to hold and pull, you know, because when she is dragged in the court, she is resisting, she is fighting. Here she has actually given up. Absolutely. It's like she has no body consciousness at all. She doesn't have it because she is one with the Krishna in her heart. She has identified herself with that. And once that comes, that's it. It's amazing. That was a observation that many might miss, that in the painting of Draupadi being disrobed, she is not actually fighting and trying to hold back the sari. Her hands are folded in prayer to Krishna and she is lost. You try whatever you want to do. Because you are not fighting against me. That is where your ego is gone. You are no longer thinking that I am this body and I am fighting against you. It's nothing. You know who I am? You have grown to the level of soham or dasoham. Either way, Swami says, you use dasoham and say that I am the meekest, I am the smallest, you are the supreme. Or you use soham where you say I and you are one. Either way, you reach that state which takes you beyond body attachment, beyond dehabhimana, and that's it. That is the magic that happens. Though nothing seems to have changed, everything has changed, and in an instant, the Pandavas are feeling grateful instead of angry. Draupadi is in bliss. The Kaurava court is shivering in fear and, you know, a kind of, what do you say, a feeling of dread.
Absolutely. The number of emotions, you know, that's why sometimes when I listen to this episode, the problem is we know that this is what is going to happen. You know, it's almost like, don't worry, Krishna will come, because we know it. That's the story. But if you look at it from the way it happens, the sequence of events, I mean, it's so very dramatic. And so beautifully Swami writes that the way Draupadi prays to Krishna, she says, Krishna, you are not coming to our rescue now. You know, nobody, I mean, we turn to you for everything. We dedicated all our actions to you. We dedicated all our decisions to you. Whatever we did, we wanted to please you. And if that is not enough, then what more do you want? And then she says, okay, if you want complete surrender, I'll give it to you now. When, how beautifully Swami writes it. He says, probably the only thing which is missing is complete surrender. And if that is what you're pushing us for, I'll give it to you. And that's when she lets go. She says, do what you will. You know, I'm not going to ask you for this or that or to come and protect me. You have my complete surrender. And that's why, you know, that's why this episode is narrated for many things. One of the things is when you immerse yourself in the Lord's name, the Namasmarana, when you do, that's, you'll do it in the truest sense when you completely lose body consciousness. And that's why almost she starts smiling when that incident is happening and she's lost in the thoughts of the Lord. She's completely unaware of what is happening around. And you can just imagine what would have been the feelings of the people in the court over there. I mean, especially the Kauravas. I mean, that's something they really did not expect. And, you know, the idea that, oh God, we have really put our hands in a place where we shouldn't have put. That feeling, you know, how many times you've done that? You know, you pick up something and you drop it and it breaks, and that instant fear that, you, oh God, what have I done? You know, oh God, I shouldn't have messed up with this.
You know, in fact, when you mentioned that Draupadi is smiling, I was reminded of this Doha by Kabir Das where he says, Dukh mein sumiran sab kare, sukh mein kare na koi. Meaning, in times of distress, everyone remembers you. In times of joy, nobody remembers you. The next line goes as, Jo sukh mein sumiran kare, dukh ka hai ko hoi. Which means, if somebody thinks of you in times of joy, why will they ever have sorrow? And mostly this is interpreted as, when you are happy, also keep thinking of God, then sorrow will not touch you. That is not the case here. Means, it is true, but the depth of understanding is that, like Draupadi, as far as all others are concerned, yes, sorrows have been heaped upon her. But sorrow is not able to touch her. That is the thing. It is not as if, like Mirabai. Mirabai was forced to drink poison. Mirabai was given whiplashes. Prahlada was thrown from the mountaintop. Prahlada had to go through fire. He was drowned in the water. When Kabirda says that Jo Sukhme Sumiran Kare Dukkha Hai Kohai, why will they feel sad? Why will they have sorrow? It means that just like a painkiller protects you from pain though there is a pain, in the same way the grace of the Lord will be such that though there is pain, there won't be suffering. There won't be suffering at all because you have gone beyond body attachment. And I just felt that we should clarify on the depth of this beautiful message that when you are with God, when they say that you have no sorrow, it just means that it doesn't matter whether you are sorrow or you are blissful according to the world. It doesn't matter whether you are hungry or well-fed according to the world. Because what matters to you is your Lord alone and you are oblivious to everything else, just as Draupadi in the most terrible of situations was able to bring a smile on her lips, close her eyes and get lost in bliss.
And many times, you know, you know that God is capable of these things, but the question is, will God come for this person I'm troubling? You know, is that person pure enough to draw the grace of the Lord? And that is what happens in the Kaurava court, because now they're looking at Draupadi and saying, oh my God, this is a real virtuous woman, you know, who could call out to the Lord, and in such a dramatic and miraculous way God comes to save her honor. What have we done? You know, Swami says they all go pale in that fear. And I'm sure Dhritarashtra would have been the most scared. Because Swami says that, you know, the Kauravas try to put up a brave face. They pretend as though they're not, hurt or moved by what they're seeing. But Dhritarashtra is literally trembling because he knows what has happened. But, you know, what a beautiful scene it is. And the difference in Swami's narration is, Swami says at this point, actually Krishna manifests there. It's not merely Krishna in a subtle form providing this grace as a flow of fabric. It's not like that, but Krishna manifests there to even comfort Draupadi. That's what Swami says. It's not merely an invisible flow of grace, but Krishna manifests there to comfort Draupadi in that moment.
As I was reading this part, Prem, I kept wondering whether, you know, when they say Krishna manifests, is it that he walked into the court, you know, at that point in time, or was it that out of thin air Krishna appeared? I kept thinking of it, and when you read that chapter again and again, you're not able to actually make out how was it, but I realized that it doesn't matter because both are equally miraculous. You know, if Krishna happened to enter the Hastinapur court exactly at this point in time when a miracle is taking place, where a world record sari is being created and Dushasana is fatigued and Krishna walks in, it's equally miraculous if he were to appear out of thin air, so it doesn't matter at all. But this is really very interesting because I did not know this before until we read Bhagwan's autobiography as Krishna, where he's saying that Krishna manifests and speaks to Draupadi. And the conversation between Draupadi and Krishna is very beautiful. Possibly we'll continue that after the break. But before we take the break, I think, Prem, I want to read out the last two paragraphs that Swami writes in that chapter before the conversation between Draupadi and Krishna. Because it is so beautiful, it is so strengthening, and it makes us see things in the true perspective, which is uplifting, elevating, and helps us evolve as well. Swami writes, good men and wise, and the wise, realized that Satya and Dharma can never come to harm. The tears of joy that rolled down from their eyes, meaning Pandavas and Draupadi, gave proof of the exaltation that they experienced. The wicked Dushasana fell down exhausted and humiliated. Draupadi did not suffer the least dishonor. All the dishonor fell to the lot of the Kauravas, and the Pandavas were unaffected. Can God permit the just and moral Pandavas to suffer humiliation? The harm that the Kauravas planned to inflict on the Pandavas recoiled on them only. This was the direct consequence of the grace that Lord Krishna showered on the Pandavas and Draupadi, and of the devotion and faith that they had reposed in Lord Krishna. Intending to declare to the world the intense devotion of the Pandavas and its efficacy, and also to hold them up as examples for the Kali Yuga that was to come, the Lord contrived this thrilling drama. There is nothing more in this than that purpose of the Lord. You may be subjected to calumny, insult and dishonor. You may be plunged in poverty or pain. But the person who has surrendered to the will of the God, will welcome each of these gladly and bear them with equanimity.
beautiful. In fact, that is why it is important to read the Bhagavata Vahini, because when Swami writes it this way, this is the actual scene when Swami says Draupadi did not undergo dishonor, the Pandavas did not suffer. I mean, from our point of view, it's so very difficult to relate to that, because even seeing this scene, as we said last time, being dramatized after so many years, it pinches you somewhere. It makes you so restless to see it. But for that moment, what would have been greater if you look at it for Draupadi? Was it the fact that she went through this horrible experience, or was it the fact that she came to know that day that nobody can harm her as long as she is surrendered to Krishna? I mean, the way it was reinforced, that faith was reinforced, probably that was much, much, much more important and greater than what she experienced. What she experienced as a woman was probably one in a million women would be put to that kind of suffering. But what she experienced as a devotee was probably one in hundreds of millions will get that reassurance from the God Himself. And we never can know what will be the real thing running in the devotee's mind. And Swami is saying that this is what it is. That they did not suffer, they did not feel the pain, because they had surrendered their will completely to God.
So I think we should keep this episode in mind, especially in those times when we feel like looking up to God and saying, "Hey God, oh Swami, what have you done? What have you done?" Because if we simply go in a very narrow-minded manner about the impact of the insult or pain, what Draupadi has gone through is definitely, definitely far, far, far more terrible than any of us can go through anything. And yet, through that most terrible thing, if she has got the greatest ever gift a devotee can possibly get, will our loving Lord not be thinking of similar gifts for us also? Don't we have faith that our God is the most compassionate? Don't we have faith that our Lord is the most powerful? If we have that faith, how can I ever think that He is not stopping something either because He is weak or either because He doesn't love me? It is only weakness of faith on our part, and it's no flaw in the master plan of God. With this thought, dear listeners, we will be going into the break. Don't go away anywhere, because on the other side of the break, we will come back and continue with another beautiful story of Lord Krishna's grace on the Pandavas and those who keep up dharma.
Krishna, Krishna, Krishna,
Giridhar Bala.
Welcome back, dear listeners. In that point where Draupadi was about to be disrobed, but she was saved by the grace of Krishna, and Swami writes that Krishna appears there to console her. But the other thing about it is, as you're saying, there is no entry or exit of Krishna, but there is no conversation of Krishna with anybody else in the court also. So it could well mean that Krishna appeared probably only for Draupadi and for her to converse with him, because now Krishna starts consoling her. She falls at Krishna's feet and she starts sobbing. And, you know, this is when everybody around is scared. The Pandavas are probably, you know, vindicated in their faith. They know, I mean, for them also it's a huge reinforcement of how nothing can touch them, you know, when they are going through the most difficult of times. Because probably in many ways this was the starting of the many troubles that they're going to undergo in life. So it starts off in this grand manner where, you know, they know that nothing is out of hand of the abilities of Krishna to save them. And at this point, Krishna starts consoling Draupadi. He says, don't worry, I've come to protect you. Nobody can touch you. You know, you're after all my devotee, and anything which is a dishonor to you is a dishonor to me. That's what actually Draupadi tells to Krishna when she's praying, that, you know, we belong to you. You know, if anything is inflicted upon us, it is inflicted upon you. It is a dishonor on your name. And the same thing Krishna reflects and says, I've come to protect you. And he says, now get up. You know, knot up your hair, which has been untied, and go back to your inner chambers.
I don't know how I forgot this one point, because when I was reading that, a strong thought arose in me. Because Swami writes that Draupadi calls out to Krishna saying that, Krishna, this is not an insult to me, this is not an insult to my husband, it's an insult to you, because we are totally yours. You know, as I read that, the thought that welled up within is, can I become like that, you know? Because once you become the Lord's, then it doesn't matter at all, because your victories are not yours, your defeats are not yours, nothing is yours, everything is the Lord's, and so it becomes his responsibility totally. And it just gives such a strong inspiration that all that we do in life, we should try to just become the property of the Lord, you know, the property of the Lord. Of course, in discourses, Swami says students are my only property. But I always feel that there's a catch when Swami says students are my only property, because there is this episode which was narrated by Sainath sir. He was saying, Swami came out one day and he said, just because you're a student of Satsang Institute of Higher Learning doesn't make you a Sai student. Are you a Sai student or are you a university student? And in different ways, Swami has asked the same thing, you know, because Brother Amay, I remember when Swami was asking him about his PhD, and he said, Swami, I will do PhD. Swami said, no, university PhD is easy. Are you ready for Swami's PhD? Mm-hmm. So there is a difference between the PhD from Satsang Institute of Higher Learning and a PhD from Swami. There's a difference between being a student of Satsang Institute of Higher Learning and being a student of Swami. A student of Swami is one who learns everything from Swami. So when Swami says students are my only property, I always feel Swami saying those who are my students are my property. So I know that students are his property, but I don't know whether I'm a true student of Swami. That's why I always feel that it's an inspiration for us that we should try to become Swami's property. Because once we become Swami's property, safeguarding the property, enhancing the property, doing whatever he wants with the property, it becomes his responsibility and we can rest assured. And we can rest relaxed. Because that is what Draupadi says, and Krishna comes. And you can only imagine how it must have been for Draupadi, having gone through this most terrible experience, which has actually become the most beautiful experience of her life, because she has realized her oneness with Krishna. She must be oozing with gratitude, you know, and that oozing gratitude is what formerly was burning anger. Burning rage has become oozing gratitude, and it's such a uplifting experience, because from the nadirs, you have been thrown up to the peaks of ecstasy. And at that moment to see Krishna, oh my God, you don't know what would have happened within her. She just falls at the feet of Krishna, and she's in both, you know, on one hand the joy that she has experienced, on the other hand, because it was an experience that was imparted to her for that moment, she has come out of that also, and she's back to remembering the humiliation, remembering all the things that have happened. We can empathize with her because it happens to us also many times when we come to Swami. You know, personally I have experienced it, a big problem burning and it's terribly torturing my heart. You sit and during darshan you see Swami, you feel so calm. But somehow that calmness lasts only till the end of Om Jai Jagadish Hare. You get back to your home, get back to your room, the problems come back again. So it's almost like God showered His grace, but we have not yet evolved to retain that and use it to sustain ourselves for our entire life. We are like vessels with a lot of holes, into which how much ever God pours grace in a little time, depending on the number of holes, we let that grace flow away and we are back to being an empty vessel again. So Draupadi is in that kind of a situation where she's at the peak of bliss. At the same time she's remembering all this, so she falls at Krishna's feet, and Swami writes that her tears have wiped away the kajal, the eye black that she has put, and that black thing has come on to all her face. It's such a paradoxical description, because the previous line Swami writes about her aura that is burning and shining bright, and here now her face is blackened by the same kajal that she has applied. So she is profusely crying, she is sobbing there, and Krishna tries to calm her. He strokes her head and he tells that your hair is disheveled. So go in to the inner chambers, tie up your hair, freshen up, you know. He's just trying to calm her down. But Draupadi is in no mood to listen to that, you know. She's in no mood to listen to that. Because she gets up and she tells Krishna, Krishna, when a cloth is torn, you may stitch it back, but still everybody will know that it's a torn cloth. In the same manner, a bride can be a virtuous bride only once. You can't be a virtuous bride once you have become a bride again. And then she says, in the same way, milk that has curdled, which has become curd, whatever you do, that it can't become milk again. A tusk of an elephant that has grown and come out, it can't go back again. You know, so through these rhetorical questions, she's asking Krishna, you think that I will get back the peace and joy of a married bride by simply tying back my hair? It is not going to happen. So through these rhetorical questions, she fires back to Krishna, saying that I don't think that I'm going to go in and tie up my hair. That is when, you know, Krishna further continues. He says, You're looking very, very scary. You're looking very terrible in this form. So why don't you, when will you then tie up? You know, you have to tie up your hair. You have to do this. That is when she pronounces a terrible vow. She says, on the day when that person, the perpetrator of this crime, is down, dead, he's torn apart, and he has become food to scavengers like the foxes and the vultures. And in that sorrow, when his wife opens up her hair and, you know, thumps her chest, wailing in such sorrow, when she opens up her hair like that, that is when I will be tying up my hair, using, you know, the blood of that Dushyasana as the lubricating oil, so that I can put my hair in place. This is the terrible vow that she pronounces in open court in everybody's presence.
You know, at one moment we were talking about the equanimity which Draupadi attained when she was chanting the name of the Lord. But as you're saying, you know, the scene is very beautiful because it actually speaks of literally three levels of devotees, or three levels that devotees go through until they reach the ultimate stage. You know, when she was saying that, oh Lord, oh, we are surrendered to you, and dishonor to me is a dishonor to you. And the next step is she's saying that if we have completely surrendered, then why am I still thinking about my honor and my dishonor? The very fact that I'm saying that my dishonor, which means I'm not completely surrendered to you. And then when this enlightenment literally strikes her, she becomes absolutely equanimous. But the beauty is there is one person who is sitting through this whole episode in that same state of equanimity throughout, and that is Yudhishthira. Because he is one who is probably not going through this up and down. Mm. Oh, I am being dishonored. Oh, but this dishonor is yours. Oh, if this is yours and I have surrendered. He does not go through any of these sequence of understandings. He is completely understood. You know, if it has to happen, it will happen. If my Lord permits that this should happen, it will happen. And I think that is what was his equanimous state. And probably the Pandavas were not even able to experience the equanimity which Draupadi experienced at that moment. Because, I mean, literally they were just in anger and they were being calming themselves, seeing Yudhishthira's face. But, you know, the moment this episode is over, she's again back to her anger, this angry self. And, you know, with due respects to what she has gone through, end of the day, she's a woman who's been dishonored in such a manner which is not acceptable at all. And her anger is legitimate in that sense. And that is why Krishna says, yes, I'll stand by you. And he says, I will ensure that your vow is completed. I will ensure that everybody who has inflicted this upon you will be destroyed, and I will overlook their destruction. And he literally gives his word, because I think that's the sequence of events. You know, in Bhagavatam, I was listening the other day, there is this beautiful description of two kinds of sins that you can do. It's called Bhagavata Apacharam and Bhagavata Apacharam.
Okay.
He says, Bhagavata Apacharam is talking nonsense and crap about God. So God will not react to that. But Bhagavata Apacharam is when you try to harm a devotee. And as we spoke last time, many times it's literally like a devotee is sent to a place so that the evil people will try to harm the devotee, and in response to that, the God will come and destroy evil. And literally, that's what Krishna was waiting for. He has put in Draupadi the words that probably he wanted to say, that I will destroy the evil. But now Draupadi has taken it up as a vow, and Krishna says, I will stand by you and I will oversee the destruction of these people who perpetrated this against you.
You know, Prem, when you say this, it is with overwhelming gratitude that I remember one or two little episodes in my life which have really strengthened me. The beautiful thing is, not all of us are capable of the kind of surrender that possibly Draupadi did. But all of us definitely go through the ups and downs the way Draupadi did. And our Swami in this Kali Yuga has been so kind. Whereas Krishna had said that Ananya Chintayantoma Ye Jana Paryupasate, those who think of me incessantly and nothing else, their yogakshema I will take care of. I think that offer, if it had been given to any of us, we would have failed, because I don't know how many of us think of him incessantly with no other thought. But Swami, on the other hand, said, if you need me, you deserve me. And needing him, definitely we feel it many times. And I feel that is such a great discount. That is such a beautiful consolation that Swami has given us in the Kali Yuga. And I remember two episodes. Both episodes where I was filled with dread, fear and anxiety because of things that were going to happen. You know, one was with relation to some event that was going to happen. One was with relation to a person. You know, I'll narrate both of them quickly. This person, you know, I felt so scared of this person and, you know, I was wondering what will happen because of the things that have happened. And it is not as if I had done anything wrong. It is just that I feared that this person might not be a good person, might not be a righteous person, and he may do such things, and all this fear was going on within me. At that point in time, you know, there was this beautiful dream, and that dream came to my mother and not me. And in her dream, she says, Swami came, and he came, stood right in front of me, and told my mother, if anyone has to touch him, they have to go through me. You tell this to him. You know, and the moment she told this to me, I felt so awesome, you know, because I felt anything that is touching me has come through Swami. And if it is touching me, it is because Swami has allowed it to touch me. Otherwise, Swami will not allow it to touch me at all. You know, that was one reinforcing episode experience. The other one, as I said, an event was more than 9 or 10 years back, you know, when there was some kind of financial difficulties in the family. There was this credit card agent whom I was speaking with and, you know, trying to clear off some things. And at that point in time, I didn't realize it. She was being legal but immoral. And she did some things where, because of which she withheld some information from me. And at the end of the day, I realized that I was paying so much more because, you know, I could have paid much less, but I was paying much more because she withheld. And she withheld because she was going to benefit from that. And I knew it and she also knew it. It's just that there was nothing illegal, so nothing I can do about it. And I felt so cheated. I felt so let down. I just felt that I didn't know about it and that's why I have been cheated. I didn't know what to do at that point in time, Prem. But again, it was an inspiration. I called her up and I spoke something which might be like nonsensical. You know, I told her, listen, madam, I'm a very good person. I have intentionally not harmed anybody in life. I don't like to do it. I try to be good as much as possible. But you know what you have done, and I feel that is not right. You have done something wrong against a good person. Be aware. Beware, okay? Beware, because I don't think good will come out of this. That's all I told Prem, and I just kept it down and I said, I'm going to forget about this. An year passed, and in his own beautiful way, you know, Swami cleared up all these financial difficulties. It's an entire story in itself, and I get tears whenever I think of it because God's grace is so beautiful. Everything cleared up. But towards the end of that year, you know, I get a call and it was a lady on the other end and I couldn't find out who it was. And when she identified herself, I got to know it was this lady, you know, who had done this to me. And immediately all that anger and rage and all that came up and I said, you don't talk to me, okay? I don't want to hear from you ever again. To my shock, she's almost broken down on the other end. And she tells, sir, if you don't mind, please don't curse me, sir. Please don't curse me. I said, I have not cursed you. No, sir, you told last time before you kept the phone, you cursed me, sir, she said. You know, I promise you, the only thing I said is I'm a good person and beware because what you have done to me is not right and it won't do good for you. That's all I said. She said, sir, please, can you take back that? The Hindi word she used was baddua. Dua means blessing. Baddua is negative of blessing. He said, can you take back that baddua, sir? Because, sir, I am a middle class lady. I'm having my own difficulties. I'm having my own troubles. Please, sir, take back this curse. And you know, I told her, listen, I have nothing against you, but I was in a very difficult situation. It was very bad. She said, I profusely apologize for that. I am very sorry. But can you please take back this? Now, at the end of that call, I felt, you know, what is it that, I don't know what has happened to her. I don't know what it is. But I just felt reinforced that, you know what? My Swami will not sit silent if anything happens. Every time when I get feelings of revenge and feelings of anger against somebody, I try to remember this and tell myself that don't. Because what you are getting is what you deserve. You have no idea of your own karma. So this is what you deserve. If it is something that you don't deserve and the other person is doing out of spite or something, don't worry. Because he is there to take care of accounts. It is such a reinforcing thing. And as I said, though we are nowhere near the purity and goodness of Draupadi, our Swami is so compassionate and loving that if we are in the kind of distress that Draupadi is in, He is there to step, He is there to be the shield, He is there to protect us like the eyelids protect the eye, and that is a very, very reinforcing and satisfying feeling to always remember.
And what Draupadi is speaking is not merely in anger, you know, because that's one thing which Krishna says. He says, Draupadi, till today you have not spoken untruth. You have not done anything which is wrong. Because of that, today what you say has to come true. You know, that power of truth which is there in your word will have to make whatever you utter as truth. So what you say will come true and I will stand by you. And I think that's when everybody in the court starts getting angry. Of course, that episode is not narrated by Swami. Dhritarashtra immediately actually nullifies the whole game till that point. He says that, no, let's scrap it off. And then he tries to lure Draupadi by offering her some boons. I think we've spoken about this before. He says, ask for a boon. And she says that the honor of my husband's have to be returned. And then he says, I'm not satisfied, ask for another boon. And then she says that whatever they've lost in material have to be given back to them. And he says, done. But you ask for one more. And that's when Draupadi says, I don't want any more. And as somebody was very beautifully narrating, it is adharmic to ask for three things from a person who's ready to give you whatever you want.
It
is always supposed to be stopped at two. And Dhritarashtra knew it very well, so did Draupadi, and he was trying to tempt Draupadi into doing a dharmic act. But even at that point of advantage, Draupadi said, no, I will not ask more than two, it is done.
Oh my God, so this, our hero over here, our Dhritarashtra, is trying to ensure that she makes a tactical error even in his so-called compassion.
Right, I mean, there was no compassion at all actually. It was only trying to protect his sons even at that point. But you know, that's how dharmic the Pandavas were, that even at that situation they knew what was their boundary. They knew that how much they can ask. Because, you know, when Dhritarashtra was asking this, she could have literally asked for the throne of,
Hastinapura.
But she knew that that was not right, and it was not right to ask more than two. I mean, that's interesting because, you know, in all our mythology, you will always find this, you know, in stories that we get from modern cultures, you would always see these three boons and three wishes. But all Indian mythological stories will only have two wishes. You know, even Dasharatha gives two boons.
To Kaikeyi.
And always you'll have this two boons and two wishes being granted, because that is the discipline they keep even in asking for many, I think.
I don't know if it's a tangential note, Prem, when you were telling about these two wishes, I just thought, because I was thinking that in our lifetime we make multiple wishes to Swami, you know, and Swami is considered as the Kalpa Vriksha. So this was a thought that used to go on in my head. If Swami is a wish-fulfilling tree, then why don't all my wishes come true? And as I spent some thought on this, the thing that came was this. Suppose I have a desire that I want to be a football player, a world-class football player. Suppose I also have a desire that I have to be a world-class cricket player. Suppose I have a desire that I also want to be a world-class tennis player. Now, in this one life, I can't do all these three, right? So, therefore, now, apart from the desires, come the priority of desires. Now, what do you want? What is your priority? If football player is priority, then because I want to fulfill your desire of being the best football player in the world, the cricket and tennis players have to be forgotten. So, it's not as if God is not the Kalpa Vriksha. It is just that in the priority of my desires, it goes away. For example, if I say that my desire is I want to see the explosion of a nuclear bomb, and if I say my desire is also world peace, I think it will be asked, what's your actual priority?
Right.
Because one rules out the other. And if we think a little deep, Prem, we'll realize that one life is enough only to fulfill one desire. That is why it is so important that we take care of what we desire. That is why in his discourses, Swami says, seek that, seeking which you will never have to seek again. Because one life is enough only for one desire. And I think this is my understanding, that is why you are given only two desires. Because actually one desire is enough, if you have latched on to the correct desire. But in case you have not, maybe two. But if you are going to the third, you surely have not got it. Because if you are asking for the third, you have got into the vicious cycle of desire, wherein You know, there is that Sanskrit shloka which says, one who has 10 wants 100, one who has 100 wants 1000, one who has 1000 wants a million, one who has million wants Indra's post, one who has got Indra's post wants Vishnu's post, one who has Vishnu's post wants Brahma's post. So there is no end to it. There is no end to it at all. It is a vicious cycle of desire which consumes us and doesn't result in anything. And I was just thinking possibly that is the reason why you're told only two desires. Because if you're going to step into the third, that means, oh no, you have not got it right. You've gone into the vicious cycle of desires. You have not yet thought deeply and to understand what is your top priority in life. Because I feel that is the case with Swami also. He's waiting to grant us our desire. But he just wants to ensure that we don't ask something foolish that we don't want 2 years later. I'm asking for a top rank in my exam. But 2 years later it doesn't matter. Because what I want is a salary that is higher than the other person. How does it matter if I'm earning only $50 a month but I am being the topper in my 12th grade? It doesn't mean a thing at all. So every time my desire is so short term. Sometimes it's even less than that, you know. So I think Swami is wanting us to think deep and develop that one desire, seeking which everything we get, and once we are ready with that desire, he is ready to grant us instantly.
And that should be the state, even in anger, even in disappointment, that you have the balance to know that you don't ask for more than, you know, you should be asking. And that is the difference between Yudhishthira, the Pandavas and the Kauravas themselves. But this is the scene which happens, but you know, many times when you look at the scene, we always say Draupadi was dishonored, the Pandavas were dishonored, because depiction of that scene will always have that, you know, they're asked to remove their crowns, they're asked to stand in a corner because they've become slaves, and all of these things. We always look at it as this was the scene where Draupadi and the Pandavas were dishonored. But Swami makes that clarification. Look at the scene and ask yourself, who was dishonored? Whose respect fell after you witnessed this scene? Was it the respect of the Pandavas or the respect of the Kauravas? Mm. And clearly you can see that who literally fell in the eye of people, as you said, that till now they could get away because whatever they did seemed legal. They could not be pointed out as and said that it's completely moral. But today, after this scene, you can say that they have fallen in the eyes of everybody, you know, whoever is going to read this, they know that they have been dishonored. The Pandavas have literally raised in everybody's point of view, because, as I said, they're not bound by chains, they're not bound by a prison wall, but they were bound only by their own word. And that really showed what men of nobility they were. So it was they who were honored and the Kauravas were dishonored. This is a very important thing, because, you know, when we are going through life, when somebody is insulting us, and we are able to keep our balance at the point of time when we are being insulted, it immediately reverses the whole thing. We are not being insulted. The person who is heaping the insult is actually insulting himself or herself. But being equanimous and being balanced at that point, you're actually becoming more respect worthy than the one who's heaping the insult.
Very well put. In fact, the Kauravas don't stop at this. As the story goes, though Swami has not penned it in the Bhagavata Vahini, everything is given back and the Pandavas return. And Duryodhana is burning that we almost had them completely, and father, what a stupid thing you did. They're invited again for a game of dice.
Right.
And again Yudhishthira and Pandavas come. Again they lose everything. And this time, you know, having learnt from the dread and fear of the previous episode, instead of trying something funny with Draupadi, they just say that the losers will have to go into a exile into the forest for
12 years and 1 year.
1 year of and 1 year of incognito, Agnyatavasam. And that is what the Pandavas are subjected to. And that also with equanimity they accept. The Pandavas give up their royal garments, wear on the bark clothes and wait into the forest. And it's when they're in the forest that the next episode happens. Unfortunately, we don't have time to cover that episode. We will be doing it during our next Bhagavata Vahini Satsang. But it's amazing, because what Swami has stated here, saying that the Pandavas are actually in a position of goodness and power compared to the Kauravas, becomes more and more evident, because we'll see that the Pandavas have materially nothing. They're having bark clothes and they're in the forest, but they are peaceful and happy. Whereas the Kauravas seem to have everything, but every day is a torture for Duryodhana, who wakes up with feelings of envy, jealousy, anger, and So though they are in the midst of material prosperity, they are actually suffering, while the Pandavas are in material poverty, but they are filled with bliss and peace. I think we shall leave that for the next fortnight of the Bhagavata Vahini.
So with that, dear listeners, we'll conclude this week's episode by, as always, offering a humble effort at Swami's lotus feet. We'll play for you a bhajan. On the other side of it, you'll be joined by Brother Chandu for the next episode of Love to Love. We'll join you again next week on the next episode of Afternoon Satsang.
Anupama Sundara Nanda Kishora Anupama Sundara Nanda Kishora Thank you. కిషో